talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Good morning. It is October 19, 2015. My name's Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And we are Movie Geeks. Welcome to this week's We Are Movie Geeks, the show. Let's get started on
Tom,
what
we was your first, how was your weekend, Tom?
Oh, my weekend was terrific. It was my wife and I's 20th wedding anniversary, so we went to New York City. How long have you been married there, Michelle?
25 years.
25 years? Oh, you got
And I've been
us.
Single.
You guys are younger.
How many years now? Way too many. So, yeah, you saw at least three plays or something.
I did. I saw three plays in New York, and it was fun. One was called
Fun Home.
I did see Fun Home. That won the Tony for Best Musical,
which is
a big head scratcher to me. The songs were so awful and so tuneless, and they weren't. There was no dancing. People just broke out into song.
It's based on a comic book.
But the one I saw that was interesting was called Therese Racan.
Yeah, with Keira Knightley.
But you know, we saw that movie at the theater less than a year ago, and about 15 minutes into it, I'm thinking this is kind of like that movie I saw called In Secret.
Yes,
with Elizabeth Olsen.
Oh my goodness!
And then about 20 minutes into it, I'm like, this is In Secret. It was based on the same book by Emile Zola, and it had Judith Light in the role that Jessica Lange played in the film, and Keira Knightley. Was that Elizabeth Olsen played her in the film, and it was Keira Knightley's Broadway debut, so it was kind of a big deal. It got a lot of publicity.
And I believe she just had a baby.
Well, she was pregnant at the Oscars, apparently.
Right,
And Fun Home. And then, of course, the best was Book of Mormon.
Book of Mormon. Oh, yes.
Which they should make that into a movie.
By the South Park Boys.
Yeah, it's so politically incorrect. It's insane. I had no idea what to expect with that one. But that was my favorite of the three.
I have a feeling.
And you know who else was in Therese Racan was David Patrick Kelly, who is, of course, best known for playing Luther in The Warriors.
Warriors, come out to play.
I did not know he was going to be in it until I got there, so I was quite excited. I was kind of... I thought I was going to be bored with this play. And then when it was over, everybody was in line to meet and greet Keira Knightley, but I was excited about meeting David Patrick Kelly.
There we go.
So I did meet him, and he signed my program, and I got my picture taken with him.
He's got a heck of a beard, too, in that photo.
And he's little in The Warriors, but he's even littler in real life. I mean, the guy can't be more than about 5'1". Yeah, he plays it's not a big part.
So what were your other celebrity signings?
I saw John Leguizamo eating lunch. We walked by this diner, and the window was wide open, and my wife goes, "Hey, let's turn around. I think that's John Leguizamo eating in that diner." So we turned back around and walked by the window, and there he was sitting there. And
he mentioned my mention of him?
He did. I said, "John, we are Movie Geeks." And he says, "Oh, I love Jim Batts." No, that didn't happen, but it should have. Yeah, I didn't want to bother him during his lunch. Yeah,
yeah.
But it was a good time, and I'll talk a little bit more about an exhibit I saw with Martin Scorsese's movie posters. Martin Scorsese's movie poster collection, which is pretty cool. I collect movie posters, so seeing his movie posters.
Oh, they're not as cool as yours.
No, he did not have an Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS signed by Diane Thorne. Or a single Charles Bronson movie poster. But besides that, it was pretty impressive. All right, let's get down to business because that's what we do. Michelle, Goosebumps was number one at the top 10 at the box office.
Oh, yeah, shocker. Audiences preferred the family-friendly Goosebumps over the gothic horror of Guillermo del Toro's Haunted House Picture Crimson Peak.
Yeah, that's not much of a shock to me, really.
Two weekends out from Halloween. Sony's Goosebumps, based on the popular book series, earned $23.5 million out of the gate to take the first place spot.
Yeah, I mean, it's got the PG-13 rating, so I think that's probably the reason it's a number one.
Yeah, starring Jack Black as author R.L. Stine, Goosebumps cost a reported $58 million to produce. Audiences 59% of who were under the age of 25 gave the film an A cinema score. Hmm. Plus, it also, great reviews and word of mouth.
What did Jim review? How many stars did you give it out of five?
Well, actually, Michael Hafford reviewed it for us. So he was a lot more generous than I would have been.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. What did he give it?
I think he gave it 3.5.
3.5? Mm-hmm. What would you have given it, Jim?
I would have maybe given it a 3, closer to, maybe just under that, whatever.
Okay. We'll listen to more of your in-depth review after we get to the top 10. Number 2?
Goosebumps also managed to beat The Martian by a hair, pushing Ridley Scott's space adventure to the second place spot for the first time in its 3-week run with $21.5 million.
That's still strong.
Halloween timing didn't necessarily help Crimson Peak. No. Distributed by Universal from Legendary Film, it failed to attract a significant audience in its debut. It came in at number 4 with 12.8 million.
Yeah. Okay. You skipped number 3.
And number 3 is Bridge of Spies from Disney, and that came in at 15.4 million.
Which is not strong for a Spielberg-Hanks film, I wouldn't think.
It debuted at 2,800 theaters. Like we said, came in at number 3rd.
It's pretty wide.
Yeah, it's a PG-13 rating. It cost $40 million to make, and most of the audience, understandably, was 25 and above. But, it's more of an Oscar movie. So I think and the older audiences are going to see that this week or the second week, probably midweek.
Yeah, I tell you, that Cold War setting, that's just a tough sell for younger audiences.
Yeah. I'm still thinking we'll see Mark Rylance with a Best Supporting Actor nomination.
Oh, yeah. I would.
Back to number 4. Crimson Peak did come in at number 4 with 12.8 million. It is one of Del Toro's lowest weekend openings.
Mm-hmm.
1997's Mimic earned only 7.8 million in its first weekend in theaters. One of the issues in this movie, starring Mia Wasikowska, Jessica Chastain, and Tom Hiddleston, is it's R-rated, therefore a more limited audience. Despite its problems, it costs $55 million to produce. It's more of a gothic romance than the classic horror fans, which is why Guillermo del Toro fans went.
And we all three saw that, so we'll review it here in a little bit. Although Michael reviewed it, and he gave it 3.5 out of 5.
Yeah, he had seen it over at Fantastic Fest a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At number 5 was Hotel Transylvania 2 with 12.2 million. Number 6, hanging in there, is Pan, 5.9 million.
Barely hanging in there.
There was a lot for audiences to see this weekend. So, number 7 is The Intern at 5.4 million from Warner Brothers Pictures.
It's hanging in there pretty well. I think it could be in the top 10 for another week, maybe. Mm.
At number 8 was Sicario with 4.5 million. Number 9 is Woodlawn, 4.1 million.
It's a Christian film about a football team in the 70s. True story.
Exactly. But it was in the number 9 spot. So you figure that movie cost probably
$10 million to make.
Maybe $1 million to make.
And they wouldn't show it to us, of course.
No. Yeah. At number 10 was Maze Runner, The Scorched Trials from 20th Century Fox with 2.8 million. At number 11 in limited release is Steve Jobs. That came in at 1.5 million. That's only playing in New York and LA for right now. It will release nationwide this Friday, including St. Louis.
Well, that's really strong for maybe less than a dozen theaters or so.
That's pretty
impressive.
And rounding out number 12, and this is all from Rentrack once again, is one of those Fathom Event movies, the Met Opera.
I've never seen those in the top 12 before.
Me too. Of note, also with the box office, Beasts of No Nations failed to ignite a day-and-date release revolution. The film, produced by Netflix, debuted simultaneously on the streaming platform and in theaters on Friday. It earned only a little more than $50,000 from 31 theaters for a lackluster $1,600 per theater.
It seems a bit counterintuitive to show it on Netflix and at the theaters. Why would you jump in your car, drive to a movie theater, park your car, pay money, and sit at the movie theater when you can watch it at home?
It's for its award season run. Yeah. So that
I understand why they did it, but I'm not surprised.
Some people are still purists like yourself. That would rather see a film on the theater or the big screen.
Jim gave it a rave review, especially for the young man.
Oh, gosh, Abraham Ada. We'll talk about him.
And we'll talk, exactly. Also, internationally, Ant-Man opened in China to 43.2 million, bringing its global take to 454.6 million. Disney recently announced that the sequel is in the works for 2017, plus it will also be released on home video December 8th for the holidays. for your Christmas shopping.
I see. Well, this weekend, everything will be wiped away by The Last Witch Hunter, I predict.
Now, the big absence from the top 12 is The Walk. It's completely gone.
Yes. It's walked away.
Yeah.
Noticeably.
I have a new theory about that. They have a term in the stand-up comedy world, too soon. That was particularly mentioned in the documentary The Aristocrats. Yeah. And maybe, even though this is not about, you know, the attack, it's still too soon for some audiences to handle anything with you know, even set near the Twin Towers. Maybe that's part of it. Although I'm sure once this is out on home video or you know, playing on you know, streaming or whatever, people are going to come up to me and say, "Yeah, I saw The Walk. Boy, that was really good. I bet it looked great on the big screen." And I'm going to say, "Yeah, it did. You know, you should have gone." You know, there's going to be discovered, and people are saying, "Well, why didn't I hear about that? Why didn't I go see that at the theater?" Well, you had your chance.
You snooze, you lose.
It only made $1.2 million this weekend. Worldwide, it's made $26
million. Oof, that's a shame, because that's a really well-done film.
It is. You know, I agree.
What are you going to do? Sometimes the timing just is not right. You know?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get started on these reviews. We've got a bunch of movies to review. Number one, Michelle mentioned, was Goosebumps.
The abominable snowman just crawled out of a book. That doesn't just happen.
You just released every monster I've ever created.
What was that?
It's the invisible boy.
He is such a crack up.
The person in this room who has seen Goosebumps is Jim, who is Jim, you said you liked Goosebumps.
Well,
or did you like Goosebumps?
I liked it all right. It is a kid's film. As I suspected last week, it is certainly kindred spirit to Jumanji.
I assume the special effects are better than Jumanji.
Sometimes.
Yeah,
they've got a lousy werewolf. I was like, guys, you know, you could have had Rick Baker make you a really nice werewolf makeup for maybe the same cost as this bouncing, rubbery CGI thing you've got careening around the supermarket. And I was like, the same with the abominable snowman from Pasadena. He's practically floats around. But some of the other effects are pretty good. The little guard gnomes are nice, but a lot of those are practical effects. I'm sure there's a lot of puppetry involved, as there was with Slappy, the ventriloquist dummy, who's the main villain in the film. He's sort of the organizer of this attack on this little town. And I will say the first, you know, half hour, you know, maybe the first half is pretty entertaining, setting up this this kid and his mom moving into this new place and encountering their next door neighbor, who was played by R.L. Stein, played by
Jack Black,
who, a restrained Jack Black.
Nobody likes a restrained Jack Black.
Well, sometimes when he's all over the place, he's certainly more entertaining in this than he has been in this HBO series he's been doing there. I think it's called The Twist or something like that. But yeah, he's very good in it. Well, then again, he's very good in the D Train earlier this year also, and that was kind of a little more restrained Jack Black. Also, there's a couple of comic performers that are kind of wasted in it. Ken Marino is in there as a PE teacher or gym coach that kind of has a flirtation with Amy Ryan's character, but he really has nothing to do in it. It's got maybe a couple of lines in it. I can't recall the actor's name. The long, lanky guy from Veep is in there as the sheriff, and he's pretty amusing. And also, the main character's aunt is an actress from Workaholics, was stealing scenes in 22 Jump Street. She's very funny, but they're kind of overwhelmed by about the second half or after the first hour by all the CGI effects.
How long a film is it?
It's probably about an hour 45. It feels longer than that because it's just constantly them running away from these creatures. Some of the little kids might get disturbed because one of the creatures is this really evil-looking clown, and that's going to give them the willies.
Jack Black and Rob Letterman did Gulliver's Travel previously in 2010.
I liked Gulliver's Travel.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Didn't I review that?
I gave it a very positive review.
But Rob comes from the world of directing CGI animated films.
Animation.
He did one of the worst ones ever with Shark Tales. But certainly Monsters and Aliens was a lot better. And
clever.
I think Monsters and Aliens is better than this film. But I have a feeling for a lot of you know, people in their 20s, you know, like a reviewer that have a fondness for the novels and the TV shows based on the novels, they're going to get a kick out of seeing a lot of all the characters sort of brought to life. There's a sequence in a graveyard with zombies that might be a little scary for the preteens. There is a couple of nice nods to sort of 50s sci-fi stuff. There's a couple of aliens running around with freeze ray guns, and they have the big sort of aquarium bubble helmets on, and they're kind of interesting. And of course, they've got that giant praying mantis, which is something out of the old 1950s Universal film. So that's kind of a nice tip of the hat to that. Like I say, it just kind of gets bogged down in people running and screaming, and you know, it's just destruction, and no one, of course, gets hurt. Mm-hmm. You know, but they do show them putting a new coat of paint on the high school at the end of the film. So, but they destroy all these buildings in the town square, and it's just a little bit much. So you know, it's for a kiddie matinee, it's okay. But there's some better films out there. That's for sure.
Better films such as Crimson Peak, the number 4 film of the weekend.
Well, I for adults, I would recommend that a little bit.
Yeah. Now so Jim sort of recommends Goosebumps, but not really.
Just, you know, a mild recommendation.
Okay. Yes. Now, the three of us all saw Crimson Peak last Tuesday night, and it came in fourth with a disappointing $12.8 million.
I can imagine the two of you in here as children.
We were not allowed in here as children. We were confined to the nursery in the attic.
That R rating.
Yeah. No, did you guys like it?
Boy, was it pretty to look at.
It was.
It's visually. My gosh.
I was commenting to Kate at one of our at a screening last week. I said it's a monster fanboy fever dream, and it. I think one of our friends there said it's really a big screensaver. You know.
Yeah, it's it looks great, the costumes.
Oh, especially on that IMAX screen, just the colors pop, and it's just, you said it only cost $55 million, and boy, it looks like it was triple the price of that, you know.
It does look more like it cost more than it did, and you know, the art direction.
But I think the phrase that really sums it up is all style and no substance.
It's just not scary, remotely scary.
And it's not that interesting. I mean, you know, the characters are sort of throwbacks to characters from classic Hollywood films.
Well, they even named the lead character Edith Cushing, which is a nice little tribute to Hammer films.
That's nice. And of course, there's the one sequence where Tom Hiddleston looks like Vincent Price in Tomb of Ligeia, he's got the sunglasses just like him in there. But some of the acting in it, Jessica Chastain is such a natural gifted actress in films like Zero Dark Thirty and The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, I think is what it was. Was called there, and here she's sort of trying to do a throwback to the more theatrical acting of the 30s and 40s. And I hate to use that term, but it almost comes off as a little campy.
Well, I think she was probably directed to do that, and she I'm sure Del Toro told her to chew the scenery, and she followed his orders, and I thought she was actually kind of fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of laughs in it there that maybe I'm thinking a couple of them maybe weren't intended as laughs in it, you know. It's crazy.
And the problem was the ghosts, they looked cool, they didn't do much. The ghosts, they rose out from the floorboards and they moaned. But if you think about it, they could have told that whole story without the ghosts.
Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, it starts off kind of creepy. It starts off kind of scary. There's a lot of like boo, you know, when she's a little girl. But if you're going to make that an R-rated movie, boy, you better make it scary, because otherwise that could have been PG-13.
Well, the R rating was for the gore.
Yeah, exactly. Which if you toned that, if you pulled that back a little, you know, it would have done better at the box office.
In the reviews, or in the interviews, they've been saying, oh, it's similar to Rebecca and Jane Eyre. Yeah. But anybody that's fans of those classics are going to be so turned off by the extreme gore in a couple of sequences. Mm-hmm. There's a scene in the shower area of a men's club early on that is just unbelievably brutal. Yeah.
It was straight out of Dario Argento, that murder scene. We talked about the art direction and how stylish it was, and it did look great, but it was almost to a fault. I mean, there was a great scene in a movie we mentioned last week called The Innocents, which I watched recently, which is one of the great, really great haunted house thrillers.
Exactly.
And there's a scene where she has this candelabra, and she's walking around this haunted house, and she's way in the background, and 90% of the image is just pitch black. All you see is the candelabra and the reflection of it on her face, and it goes, and the scene goes on and on and on. It becomes unbearably suspenseful. Well, they sort of recreate that scene in Crimson Peak with Mia Wasikowska, and she's got the candelabra. They spent all this money on the art direction, so they just use that scene to show off the art direction. Mm-hmm. There's no suspense.
There's no substance. It's
I'm always rooting for Guillermo del Toro. I think he's so imaginative.
He's obviously a lover of movies.
And he's mm-hmm. talented.
And the movies that we like, he loves.
Yeah, yeah. I can say he's a big monster kid from Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, I just... Not since Pan's Labyrinth have I really warmed up to anything he's done. That may remain his masterpiece for the time, at least for the time being, I guess. But like I say, the art direction will definitely be up for some Oscars.
I think the costumes definitely, art direction maybe. But if it continues to bomb, which it looks like it may, I wouldn't expect much. Costumes, it'd be hard to ignore.
Man, that hole in the house, I'm like, what? And they open up the entrance to that house, and there are leaves falling, and I was like, there's a huge hole at the top of it. You think that they could take a little money and fix that?
He's made that engineering device out of. It's like, wait, what?
It's like you can't patch that huge hole where you're getting a bunch of snow in there that's even drifting down to the basement, for goodness sakes, and the walls are dripping blood almost. Yeah. It's so weird.
So we sort of admired Crimson Peak, but we sure wish it had been a lot scarier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when Crimson Peak was over, I actually had to jump in my car and drive over to the Chase Park Plaza.
I did.
Well, they were showing Goodnight Mommy, which is this Austrian German language horror film that I had been reading about. Michael had seen it last year at Fantastic Fest and had thought it was great, and I didn't want to miss it. So I drove over and I saw Goodnight Mommy, and talk about two polar opposites as far as horror films go, in just terms of approach and style, where Crimson Peak was stylish but not scary. Goodnight Mommy was just the opposite. It's about these two identical twin boys who live in rural Austria in kind of this drab house, and they're introduced sort of playing out in the woods, playing hide and seek, but one keeps disappearing, which upsets the other, but they're talking about, oh, mommy's coming home today. So they get home, and mommy has come home, and you don't know where exactly she's come home from, but you assume it's from the hospital because her face is wrapped in these bandages. And she's changed a bit, and the two twins don't trust her. She sort of comes between them, and they come to the conclusion that she is indeed not their mommy.
Well, these twins about 7 or 8 years old?
No, they're more like 9 or 10.
9 or 10, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they tie this poor woman up and they torture her. They're kind of cruel kids in the first place. They're shown torturing bugs with magnifying glasses. And, of course, after they tie mommy down, they pull out the magnifying glass as well and the super glue and all kinds of nasty things. Mm-hmm. But like I said, there's no music in the film. There's not much to look at in terms of cinematography or art design. Everything's sort of drab. But unlike Crimson Peak, it's scary, and it really, really got under my skin. And there's a twist, and the twist is a doozy. There was kind of a twist in Crimson Peak, I guess, but... I think everybody saw that one.
Yeah,
The twist in Goodnight Mommy is quite the doozy. And if you've ever seen a similar movie from 1972 called The Other, which is also about young twin boys.
It's a Tom Tryon book.
Yeah, it was based on a book by Tom Tryon. They sort of steal the twist from that, but I didn't really see the twist coming. It's a really, really good horror film. But unfortunately, it's not playing here in St. Louis anymore. It played a week and has disappeared. It does come out on Blu-ray on December 1st. And I think we will be having a contest giving away a few extra Blu-rays at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. So if you get a chance to see Goodnight Mommy, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be on the video on demand around that time probably also.
So that's Goodnight Mommy. Another movie that opened last Friday, and we mentioned this a minute ago, was Beast of No Nation, which is also on Netflix. But Jim saw it at the screening, and he liked it a lot. Jim, tell us about Beasts of No Nation.
All of you that have seen your family killed, you now have something that stands for you. It has put the weapons of this war back in the hands of you, the young. You're powerful.
Oh, it's a powerful, powerful film. I believe the director is Kari Joji Fukuyama.
Ooh, good job.
Yeah, something like that. I'm close to it. I'm in that neighborhood. But yeah, he's the director of what we talked about, Jane Eyre. He was the director of the last version of Jane Eyre that starred Mia Wasikowska and Michael Fassbender. And he's gotten a lot of acclaim lately for directing the entire first season of True Detective over on HBO.
Yeah, it was excellent.
Was that close to his name, by the way? Yeah. I guess. Yeah, okay, good.
Close enough.
He adapted this film also and was director of photography. This film is getting a lot of attention since it's the first film produced by Netflix, and it's I think there's a little bit of a backlash. There's maybe a sort of a blacklist of the film by certain film chains or theater chains that will not play it in their premiere screens.
Because it's on Netflix?
Because it was on Netflix, Netflix did produce it. But bravo to Netflix for kind of going out on a limb and not going with, you know, something safe like a nice teen comedy or mm-hmm.
What's it about?
It is about child soldiers, pretty much.
What country does it take place?
Well, it's set in Africa, but it's sort of they're not naming the nation itself. I think at one point they mentioned about how they're being helped out by Nigerian soldiers.
English language?
Some of it is in English. Some of it is subtitle. So they might be close to the same country where Owen Wilson was running around in No Escape. Oh. You know, they never really come out and name it. The government is fighting some rebels. There's two or three different splinter groups from them. The main character is this little 8 or 9 year old boy named Agu, who is played by Abraham Atta in one of the most spectacular child performances ever committed to screen. He's really, really wonderful. There's some talk about maybe trying to get him in the best actor category.
But would he be eligible if it premiered on Netflix?
It's in theater, so it's eligible. That's why they released it in 31 theaters in 30 U.S. cities.
So that
it will qualify for an Oscar run.
I think it could happen for his performance. It might even... Well, the only actor in it that we really know is Idris Elba, and he's more of a supporting character in it, but he's very important. But this little boy, Agu, he's living in this little village that's sort of in the buffer zone. It's sort of protected from the warring forces. He's having fun with his friends and his family. He's got two or three siblings. It's a pretty nice little life until, of course, the talks between the rebel forces and the government break down. They do away with the buffer zone, and of course they come charging in. His mother and a couple of the younger siblings are able to escape. There's limited transportation out of there, so the men decide they're going to stay and hide and sort of protect their homes, and of course that doesn't work out when the government comes in and believes they're rebels. Agu escapes after witnessing the demise of his father and brother into the jungle. He's lost, he's hungry, and he stumbles across one of these rebel groups. And of course, they take him in, even though he's a little kid. The leader of the rebel forces is played by Elba as the commandant, and he tells one of his guys that says that Agu is too small. He says, "Well, tiny fingers can pull triggers." So he is a despicable character. You get to see the training of Agu and some of the other young boys that they brought in. It's brutal. It's unflinching. There's a sequence when Agu has to make his first kill, and it is one of the most tense, you know, just nail-biting sequences put on film in the last year or so.
How many stars did you give it?
I think I gave it 4.5. Now, there's no rating on it. I'm assuming that they didn't submit it. I thought that this might be because of the subject matter or because, you know, you get to see children actually killing. But I was reminded that one of the soldiers doesn't wear pants, and there's a couple of sequences where you can kind of tell what's going on.
Maybe he just forgot his pants.
Well, it's kind of hot in that jungle there. And it's a tough thing to sit through some of the sequences, but it's really, really a strong film. Very, very powerful.
Yeah. There were a few people that walked out of the Telluride screenings earlier. The movie cost $6
million. But were they wearing pants?
Yeah. It cost $6 million to make, and Netflix paid for the rights for $12
million. Jim really recommends Beast of No Nation. Jim also saw Labyrinth of Lies. Jim, tell us about Labyrinth of Lies. Is that playing in town, or is that open this week?
That will open Friday, I believe, at Plaza Frontenac. This is a German-language film set in Germany in 1958. date. Once again, as with Bridge of Spies, we're going back to the Cold War. Actually, this is set 2 or 3 years before the Bridge of Spies is set. This is set in 1958, and there's talk about dividing Berlin and dividing the country amongst the communist forces and the U.S. forces. This is about a young man who's a lawyer working for a prosecuting attorney working for the government, mostly doing traffic cases and things like that. And then he hears about a person that has spotted one of the guards from Auschwitz. And of course, a lot of the people in his office don't want to pursue this. It turns out that they can persecute people that were part of the Nazi party or guards at these camps that committed atrocities if they committed murder, if they're witnesses to that. The rest of the stuff is taken care of by the statute of limitation. And so even though he's gotten some pressure, the attorney general wants him to pursue it. And this is all about him trying to find the truth. What's amazing is most people living in Germany don't know what Auschwitz was. They thought it was just a little detainment camp and had no idea what was going on there. A lot of them did know and want to try to forget about it, sort of push it under the rug. It's like it's spilt milk, that sort of thing.
Hence the title, Labyrinth of Love.
Exactly. Right. And it's a very well done film. Right. It's
how many,
it's based
how
on
many
true
stars
stories.
Are you going to give it? For
I'm
your
probably
going
to give it 4 stars. I think it could be a contender for the best foreign film
All right.
Oscar.
All right. So look for Jim's review of Labyrinth of Lies Thursday evening at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. This is going to be a busy week for geeks as far as seeing upcoming films. Today at 2 o'clock, we're all seeing Spotlight.
The Boston priest molested kids in 6 different parishes over the last 30 years. The church found out about it and did nothing. We haven't committed any long-term investigative resources to the case.
No, we haven't.
And that's the kind of thing your team would do.
Spotlight.
And that's what about the Catholic Church?
Yeah, I guess
sex
it's
scandal.
Mostly about the group of newspaper reporters. Yeah. I guess, was that a Boston?
Boston Globe.
Okay. Boston Globe, right.
Michael
right.
Keaton, Mark Ruffalo. Who else is in there?
But Liev Schreiber is in it. Okay. John Slattery is in it. So Ruffalo and Michael Keaton. Mm-hmm.
Rachel McAdams.
Oh, it looks like it's a pretty
And when
good
does that open? That doesn't open this Friday, does it?
That opens up first weekend of November.
Okay, so we'll be reviewing Spotlight pretty soon. Tomorrow night, there are screenings of Steve Jobs and The Last Witch Hunter.
Yay.
We flipped a coin to see who gets to see what. Jim lost, so I get
not.
To see The Last Witch Hunter.
Do you know what it's like to live forever?
Your immortality has made you the greatest soldier of the Axon Cross in a war between our world and the next.
Elias.
Which stars Vin Diesel in a role that obviously Nicolas Cage turned down. It looks like about a half a dozen Nick Cage movies from the past decade. I don't know much about it. It was directed by Breck Eisner, who did Sahara, which was a big bomb with Matthew McConaughey a few years ago. It looks pretty cheesy. Michelle's going too. Are you looking,
oh, yeah.
you looking forward to Last Witch Hunter, Michelle?
I cannot wait.
So Breck is the poor man's Brett Ratner. Is that what you're
That's
saying?
That's right. Oh, I'm sure he'd be so happy to hear that. I cannot wait for this. As soon as I heard that it was all about immortals and all that kind of, and of course, a curse, and he's separated from his family, and he's got his epic battle, but Vin Diesel, Elijah Wood,
Michael
Caine.
Michael Caine.
See? So Tom and I are going to go see Last Witch Hunter. And like he said, Jim, you lose with Steve Jobs.
Yes.
No, Jobs. I don't think so. Elijah Wood's playing a priest. He's out selling this movie, though. I'll give him that. I saw him with Colbert last week. So
who's that?
Oh, Elijah Wood. He's out there selling us things.
Yeah. Right.
And he's a horror fan, too.
Well, somebody's got to sell it.
Yeah, between right. that and Cooties.
Yeah, I'll be reviewing that.
We're not going to get Cooties, I don't
we
think.
We are not going to get Cooties.
Look for my review of The Last Witch Hunter Thursday night. And look for Jim's review of Steve Jobs. Which is Danny Boyle's new movie.
I think Kate's going to be reviewing.
Kate Marquis is going to. Okay. Yep, Marquis, she's going to.
What else are we seeing this week? Truth. That's I can't see that. I was actually going to review that, but I guess that's the ironically named movie about Dan Rather being forced out of CBS in disgrace for showing falsified documents in order to affect a presidential election back in 2004.
That created quite a firestorm this past
week. Yeah, they're
trying
to make Rather look like the hero here.
CBS reports are, we ran a few clips on Friday of Cate Blanchett and Robert Redford, and CBS issued a statement saying they denounced the movie. They said it's a disservice to the public and to their journalists, and they refused to run any TV spots promoting the film. However, and this came also when Sony Picture Classics said, hey, we tried to buy multi-million-dollar ads for it, and CBS said, no, thanks. However, the film's stars have been on various CBS shows, late night, all over, morning shows, you name it.
Yeah, Kate promoting, was on, yeah, Kate
promoting
was on
Colbert, the, yeah. Exactly, promoting the movie. So,
right, so who's reviewing that one?
I think, let's see, I don't know. Is that, when does that open? Is that, it's not open this Friday.
No,
is
it, no? I think no. It opens the weekend after next.
This we'll have to
all
see.
Right. Well, we'll see. Yeah, all right. Yeah, so look for a review of Truth. Look for a review of Gem and the Holograms. Melissa's reviewing that?
Yes.
Okay, well, I don't know much about that, but who cares? And what else are we seeing this week? Rock the Casbah Bill Murray, which opens, that opens this Friday.
I was a rock tour manager, and this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to tour with my act.
To Afghanistan?
I don't know a whole lot about it. I know Bruce Willis is in it, and I think it takes place in Iraq. And does Bill Murray, play a comedian?
I thought he played, a rock music
promoter. Oh, maybe,
he's
maybe
a
that's
promoter.
It. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Also, we're going to get to see The Room on Wednesday night.
Well, it's not The Room. The Room stars Tommy Wiseau. Yeah.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
Room.
You're tearing me apart, Lisa! Room, which stars...
Brie Larson.
Brie Larson. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then actually the young actor from that is getting a lot of Oscar buzz, too.
So. All right. So that opens a week from Friday. I'm actually reviewing Room. So next Monday you can listen to us review Room. Love the Coopers we're seeing.
That's
Friday. A Christmas movie. I think that opens for at least another month.
Yeah, I think that is playing at SLIFF, though. Okay. I'm pretty sure that's
like a Thanksgiving release.
And it's got a lot of stars in it, so it looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, Diane Keaton, yeah.
All right. So lots to look forward to. Oh, in St. Louis's weekend, at the midnight show over at the Tivoli, is the Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's this weekend at midnight's at the Tivoli, and the following weekend at midnight at the Tivoli. We do this every year. We end the midnight series with Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's always a lot of fun. It always sells out.
Sells out all both weekends. I would imagine Halloween, definitely.
Yeah, all four screenings will be sold out. It's got this shadow cast, the Samurai Electricians. And they actually get up on stage at the Tivoli and they act it out in front of the screen, which sounds kind of obnoxious, but it's actually more fun than it might sound. Did you ever see Rocky Horror at the Varsity back in the day?
No, the first time I saw it was at the Biograph Theater in Chicago, the theater where John Dillinger bought it.
Oh, yeah.
It was a staple there on Fullerton for many, many years, Fullerton and Lincoln.
In St. Louis, we had it at the Varsity. First time actually I saw it was at Webster University, but they played it at the Varsity after that, and it played from about 75 until the Varsity closed in 87 every Friday and Saturday at midnight, and it was a big event. And it still is a big event. I mean, not much has changed. Everybody dresses up and throws stuff at the screen.
And this year is the 40th anniversary.
That's right.
It's all over Internet Movie Database. Yeah. Your story actually is the first thing on IMDb.
Good.
So the stars they're still out. Susan Sarandon's doing a special Q&A at the Royal Albert Hall in London.
Yeah, well, she's really embraced that.
But you can't bring your own stuff to throw at the screen anymore. Mm-hmm. You have to buy a prop bag, which back in the Varsity days, everybody just came in with their own bag of stuff to throw at the screen. Now you have to, for $3, you have to buy a prop bag.
And actually, the midnight screen has been featured in different feature films, of course, in the movie Fame back in, I guess, 1980. And then more recently with the Perks of Being a Wallflower, they all dress up and go to Rocky Horror. So it's weird. It's a film, then became an event, and then it's been shown on in other films. So it's very odd.
Did you catch Entertainment Weekly's, their 25th anniversary
thing? The reunions?
They showed and one of the reunions focused on Rocky Horror
Rocky
Picture.
Horror. I guess they're all... Still
with Misery. Yeah. That was nice.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. So that's this weekend. Also, we want to talk about The Force Awakens, which is the new Star Wars movie. When's it open? December 18th? That's coming up. And tickets go on sale like today. They did. I think they did.
You know who also moved to December 18th besides Sisters is the next Alvin and the Chipmunks movie.
Oh,
and they had
brother.
Their own special Star Wars poster. It was hilarious. We posted that last week.
I haven't seen the new Star Wars poster. Somebody describe it to me.
Disney released it last night because, of course, it was October 18th. It has everybody on the poster, including Han Solo, Harrison Ford, and Carrie Fisher, Princess
Leia.
Is
Darth Vader on the poster?
No. Everybody is on the poster, all the new cast, except
Luke Skywalker.
Which was very noticeable because, of course, the internet, Twitter, social media all blew up, and everybody said,
Mark Hamill.
Where's Mark Hamill?
Why did they, do we know why?
We have not seen Mark Hamill in costume. We haven't seen anything of Mark Hamill.
Are we sure he's in it?
We're hoping tonight, Disney announced yesterday when they also sent out the poster that tonight The Force Awakens will debut the new trailer on ESPN's Monday Night Football tonight during the halftime show. It's the game between the New York Giants and the Philadelphia Eagles. Then after the trailer premieres, you can buy your tickets for the December 18th opening, which everyone's been waiting for.
Now, of course, most of my friends on Facebook commented about the poster. Their main comment about that is it wasn't by Drew Struzan, the great illustrator of posters, who has illustrated all the other Star Wars posters, a lot of Spielberg's posters, the Back to the Future posters. Mm-hmm. And this is more of a sort of Photoshop, different photo images, sort of off on top of the, what was his name, Ren, the sort of Darth Vader character from this film. Mm-hmm. And we're still hoping we're going to get a closer, more illustrative poster later on. But this makes it look pretty exciting.
Yeah. Right, well, it's the first character poster.
Well, speaking of movie posters, I think I mentioned I went to New York over the weekend at the Museum of Modern Art. They have a collection of Martin Scorsese's personal collection of movie posters. I collect old movie posters myself, so I was interested in seeing what one of my favorite directors had in his collection. I think the exhibit is up for, I think it's only up for a few more weeks. So if you're in New York, you want to check out Marty's movie poster collection. It's pretty impressive. He's a big fan of, always a big fan of like Val Lewton and the Jacques Turner films. So he's got a 3-sheet for the Cat People and 1-sheet for I Walked with a Zombie. He's got a 1-sheet for Gun Crazy, which is my favorite film noir movie. I've actually bid on that poster on eBay a couple of times. And, he's got a lot of European posters for famous films from the 40s and 50s and 60s. He's got an amazing poster for The Killers, Don Siegel's The Killers with Lee Marvin, Ronald Reagan, and a great poster for Eyes Without a Face. I took pictures of every single poster and I actually put them up on my Facebook page last night.
The foreign posters for American films are sometimes so entertaining. We were just talking about Star Wars, and as I recall, I think it's the Italian Star Wars poster. They've made Luke Skywalker into this blonde, almost Hercules-looking character in it. It's very entertaining.
He's also had the Sullivan's Travel poster, which has got that caricature of Veronica Lake on a yellow background, sort of an iconic poster. All kinds of stuff. Scarface from 32.
Oh, yeah. Do you have any Hammer stuff?
No, he did not. I know he's always been a big champion of Hammer films, but he didn't. I'm sure he does in his personal collection. There's only maybe 40 posters. They didn't have a whole lot of room for everything he owned. So
wow, that's quite a collection.
He did have a poster from Laura, a European poster from Laura with Vincent Price.
Oh, now that would have been.
And not a lot of horror. I mean, he had like some fantasy stuff. Thief of Baghdad was in there. Heaven Can Wait with David Niven.
Right.
A lot of crime stuff. But he's a big movie buff and appreciates fine art. What's Scorsese working on these days?
He's producing. HBO has been running the promos for Vinyl. It's a miniseries coming up that he's producing with Mick Jagger. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a TV series, a miniseries. Okay. It starts in January. He's also last night. The Hollywood Reporter ran a story last night, early this morning. He's being celebrated at the Lumiere Film Festival in Lyon, the birthplace of cinema, with the Lumiere Award. Martin Scorsese reflected on his career before the festival came to a close. He also talked about, film. Somebody asked him about the women characters in his movies. And he mentioned the Academy had nominated more women in his films, 11 or 12, more than men. Mm. So he said he's trying to work on more female-centric projects coming up. He did cite like 1993 Age of Innocence, that one that stands out.
I think they got a couple. I think was Winona nominated for that?
I think Winona was and Michelle Pfeiffer was. Yeah.
Lorraine Bracco was nominated for Goodfellas and Ellen Burstyn won for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
And Cate Blanchett.
Aviator.
She won for the Aviator.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. You don't think, right at the top of your head, you don't think of him directing powerful women characters because you think of his crime films. But
and
yeah.
that's what he said too. Yeah.
Well, so. He's going to catch up to Woody here pretty soon. Woody Allen, you know, with his penchant for directing films with women that'll go on to win the Oscar. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but, what are some of Martin Scorsese's favorite films?
2013, he came out. Somebody asked him, and so that kind of spread all over. They asked him what his 10 favorite films were.
Of all time?
Of all time, and right off.
And how many Martin Scorsese films are on that list?
Yeah, exactly. I know, good. Good point. First one was 2001, A Space Odyssey.
That's his favorite film of all time? Or is this just like an alphabetical list?
That was the 10 that was listed from the article.
That's alphabetical, I can tell.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Then 8.5, yeah. Fellini's movie.
Yeah.
Ashes, Citizen Kane, The River, The Searchers by John Ford.
The Leopard.
Vertigo. But then earlier this year, Sight and Sound and a couple other sites, he gave an interview about the 85 films that filmmakers, you know, up-and-coming filmmakers should see. Mm-hmm. And it is quite a list. Jim, what was on?
Oh, well, what came to that I viewed right away were some of the noir stuff, like the 1940s Raw Deal and T-Men, but also, of course...
You got Gun Crazy on there.
Yeah, Gun Crazy, and he's got... Jason and the Argonauts.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Touch of Evil.
Peeping Tom is in there. And the original Cat People. You mentioned that earlier.
So we like Marty. Marty has good taste in films. Oh. And he makes great films.
Yes.
That's what his next theatrical project is.
Yeah. Well, you've been talking about doing the story of Dean Martin for the longest time. I don't know if that's ever going to happen or not.
I wonder who he would cast in that. I hope
well,
not.
He was talking about Tom Hanks a few years ago.
Well, how about like a big Italian guy instead of Tom Hanks? Come on.
And then he was going to have Jim Carrey as Jerry Lewis.
I can see that.
Yeah.
He is directing one of the episodes of Vinyl, which, you know, will be on HBO in 2016.
Yeah, he directed one of the, or a couple of the Boardwalk Empires, too, didn't he? And that was a show that he produced on HBO.
Another director who we admire is Steven Spielberg, whose Bridge of Spies opened at number 3 with $15.4 million. Steven Spielberg... what was his last movie? Lincoln? So he hasn't made a movie
in
3 years.
It's been a while.
You know, yeah. I guess he produces and keeps busy.
Oh, yeah.
He's been around since the late 60s, Spielberg has.
It's hard to believe. Yeah, he started in television.
In television, yeah. Directed some Marcus Welby episodes. A couple of Night Gallery episodes, which are kind of known for their direction.
And Name of the Game. And, of course, then the TV movie that he did.
Duel.
It's a classic.
That may have kind of put him on the map in some ways. Sugarland Express, I think, was... Another, it may have been his first theatrical hit that people really took notice of him. And then, of course, Jaws.
I just found out that a girl got killed here last week. And you knew it. You knew there was a shark out there. You knew it was dangerous. But you let people go swimming anyway.
June.
Yeah. It sort of started the summer blockbuster.
That is still considered this day to be the grandfather of the summer blockbuster. And that movie won 2 Oscars for editing and for score, best score.
What's your favorite Steven Spielberg movie? Or as they call him on The Simpsons, Senor Spielbergo.
Jaws is actually my all-time favorite film, too.
Yeah.
So, but yeah.
Jaws. And your favorite Spielberg movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. What's your favorite Spielberg movie, Jim?
I'm going to go with Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. A film from Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
The first appearance of Indiana Jones, and I still say the best.
Huh.
It's a super serial. It's 12 cliffhangers, you know, all jammed together into a fantastic 2 hours, and it's just enormously entertaining.
It is pretty remarkable. Again, I'd have to go with Raiders of the Lost Ark or 1941. 1941 is the Spielberg movie that I watch over and over. It just gets funnier every time you see it. And I think that was kind of considered a bomb back in 1979.
Oh, a huge bomb, yeah.
But I think it's sort of developed a reputation as being somewhat ahead of its time, and it's got such an amazing cast. You know, you've got Baloo Belushi and Aykroyd and John Candy, and then you've got people like Warren Oates and Robert Stack and
Christopher Lee.
Yeah, Christopher Lee and Taishiro Mifune. I mean, you just watch it today, and of course Eddie Deason. Let's not forget Eddie Deason.
You see Christopher Lee, Taishiro Mifune, and Slim Pickens in the same scene. For goodness' sakes, it's got a terrific score by John Williams. Yep. I love that opening it march is very interesting.
But all, you know, all our favorite Spielberg movies date back over 30 years, which is kind of interesting. But he's certainly made a lot of good films. He made a few kind of lousy films. Hook.
Boy, I just, you know, I have a friend of mine that just can't get through that. He's tried it several times, and it just gets on his last nerve.
That's becomes, you know, for some fans, it's become like a cult.
Oh,
you know,
I know.
Classic. Yeah, we showed it at the Tivoli at midnight.
And you said people.
Yeah, and people showed up.
People in their 20s just adore that film. Same with the Goonies, the film he produced.
Yeah.
They just love that. So.
Always. I think that was a kind of a forgettable one he did in 89.
Except it's the last film appearance, I believe, of Audrey Hepburn.
That's right. Audrey Hepburn. Yeah. And that year, it also, 1989 was Always and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Oh, yeah.
So he released two that year.
And, of course, that the year of 1993 is pretty incredible also. Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Two releases.
Jurassic Park and Schindler's List.
Yeah, which won him his first Best Directing Oscar.
But just to have the same, just within months of each other, just two films that couldn't be more different, you know, incredible.
That's why he took a four-year break. We didn't hear until 1997 with The Lost World and Amistad.
Yeah,
have you ever seen Amistad?
Mm-hmm. Never made it through the whole thing, no. Yeah. It pops up on cable every once in a while.
It doesn't. It didn't really work.
Yeah. And I never saw The Terminal. Because
I never saw The Terminal either. Have you ever seen The Terminal?
Yes. I think the world of that movie, it's one of his, it's almost like a non-Spielberg type of film.
Yeah.
It just looks too cute to me. So I can't bring myself.
Catherine Zeta-Jones,
that's what I'm saying.
Was...
It doesn't, it really doesn't, feel, Stanley Tucci, yeah, it doesn't, it doesn't feel like a Spielberg movie.
But when he gets cute, boy, sometimes it doesn't work. It's like, well, it's his segment of the Twilight Zone movie.
Oh, it's the worst of the four segments.
Yeah, As all the episodes from the original series you could remake into a, you know, as part of a feature film, he picks that one.
Pick the Can was the name of his episode.
About the Eye of the Beholder or Monsters Are Due on Maple Street or something like that.
Who's that old black actor from Cuckoo's Nest?
Oh, Scatman Brothers.
Scatman Brothers, yeah.
But 1998 came Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, his second Oscar.
Which law? Lost
Shakespeare. A friend of mine still insists that Shakespeare in Love was more deserving, and everybody else I've talked to says,
"Good night, nurse." That was only because the Weinstein.
Yeah,
you know,
they pushed that, and everyone else says that. Well, they had that big poll, I think, in Entertainment Weekly, where a resounding, you know, like 85% or something like that said, "Yeah, Saving Private Ryan should have won Best Picture."
Munich's a good one too.
Yeah, Munich is really strong. I've recommended it to some folks that haven't seen it.
Like, that's another year where he released two big, you know, War of the Worlds came out, and then Munich, 2005.
But Jim, you like Raiders of the Lost Ark more than Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
Oh, yes!
Oh, my goodness. Were you either of at that, we got to see that at that Sunday screening, afternoon screening?
No, that's
they
not
showed,
the
they
group.
Showed that
I,
to
I,
us.
I wasn't a geek.
Okay,
I
yeah,
a,
no,
I
they
became a geek in November of 2008.
You mean they had the press screening on a Sunday afternoon, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was, oh, and it was kind of, they let us know like that Friday.
Oh,
it was a bizarre. It was like, oh well, guess
that's
what?
Weird.
I don't think it's not that bad. I mean, Shia LaBeouf.
Well, no one could have made that part work, but it was just a terribly written film. And
it had some fun effects and some fun action sequences with the big ants.
Oh yeah, but boy, it just kind of lays there for most. It's the weakest of the four Indiana Jones films. I think the every time I watch Temple of Doom, I appreciate it a little bit more. People were kind of disappointed with that when it first came out, and I was like, no, there's some parts of that are pretty strong. You know,
backing up to 2001, the more I see AI, the more I appreciate it. The more I fall in love with that movie. Different
it's
parts
a sad,
of it.
It's a sad film. It's very melancholy.
You know, he took it over from Kubrick. Yeah, what an incredible film that is. It is. It is very sad, especially if you're a parent and the ending is just...
Yeah, where he goes back and wants to spend one day with his mom, like baking cookies or something. I could sort of relate to that.
It's just, yeah.
So his new movie is Bridge of Spies, which isn't doing great, but you guys think it's a great movie. I'm going to go see it this week.
I do.
We're going to have to wrap this up. Doggone it. Seems like we just got here. I say that every week. Next week, we'll be back and we'll review Rock the Casbah. We'll review Spotlight. We'll review Room, Steve Jobs, and you'll get to hear me review The Last Witch Hunter. So check us out again next week at We Are Movie Geeks, the podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
We'll see you next week.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, black leather.
Oh, lorry, Steve. Hello, Don. Hey, hey, hey.
Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather, rock.